Hello there. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, and we're broadcasting locally on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, and streaming globally online at WGXC.org. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. Today, we will be discussing the Hudson River School art movement. And we have two guests today. Actually, one is a little bit late, so we'll start with Peter, who's actually here. Peter Young is owner of Peter Young Fine Arts here in Hudson, specializing in 19th and 20th century paintings. He also has served on the boards of the Olana Partnership and the Hudson Opera House. And he's also led the effort to restore the Sanford Robinson Gifford and the Gifford family graves in Hudson. So thank you, Peter, for being here. And
happy to be here. I see snow out the window. It's sort of a scenic backdrop we have for this afternoon.
I know, it's wonderful. And Peter, are you a painter by chance?
I'm not. Actually, I come out of the music world. I moved to the East Coast from the Midwest. I'm actually from Minnesota originally. Came east to play string bass with various acoustic and folk groups up and down the Hudson Valley. And then sometime in the mid-80s, a friend took me to the National Gallery in Washington, and I had sort of a religious conversion. I had never grown up around great American oil paintings. I really hadn't seen anything in the flesh. And once I attended that museum and saw spectacular American pictures, I literally walked out with goosebumps. It was an extraordinary experience. Woke up the next morning absolutely determined to be involved with art in some fashion, and I didn't have any experience. I had no academic training, but I had the passion. And so really I just began learning in whatever fashion I could. That included going to auctions, visiting galleries in New York City, reading literature, most importantly, buying paintings at a very low level here in country auctions in the Hudson Valley. And we have quite a few. One of the fun things about living here is that on a Friday or Saturday night in the Hudson Valley, there's an auction somewhere. And usually these are estate sales with a general assortment of goods, which could include furniture and rugs and silverware and everything that comes out of grandmother's attic. And I started buying very inexpensive pictures, trusting my instincts only. I didn't have any academic knowledge, and did well enough to feel encouraged about it, and got lucky a couple times with pictures and made enough money to keep gas in my car and and keep looking. And in the course of doing that, I met a lot of folks. I sort of developed a network of friends and business associates that I maintain until this day. And very slowly kind of worked my way up the ladder. And it was the Hudson River School of Painting, of course, that I found the most attractive. I was fortunate in the 80s. I was doing some work with a fellow who did tree maintenance. He was out of Red Hook, New York. He called himself Silver Mountain Tree Service. And some folks might recall the massive wet snowstorm that we had in the 80s that broke all the branches here in the Hudson Valley. We woke up to about a foot of wet snow on the branches. What happened was my friend and I got the contract to do the tree maintenance and the cleanup after that storm at Olana. So in the middle of October, I'm up at Olana in that spectacular location working on trees. And that was a really wonderful opportunity for me to get a better sense of the Hudson Valley. The vista up there, of course, is inspiring. The house, of course, contains Frederick Church's paintings and a lot of ephemera and memorabilia. And ultimately, I ended up on the board of directors there. But it all started with a snowstorm.
With snows and trees.
Yes.
Well, can you explain for our listeners what the Hudson River School is?
Sure. The parameters that define the Hudson River School are something we could sort of discuss and argue about forever. I think most people would accept that it falls roughly within a 50-year period from about 1830 till about 1880. And when we use the term school, of course, we're speaking generically. Mm-hmm. We're speaking of school as a catch-all term for a style of painting. There wasn't actually an academy or a school.
Or classes. Or,
right. And the artist who's generally thought of as the father of it all is Thomas Cole. Born in England, came to this country, and was one of the first to really explore the Hudson Valley and situated himself in Catskill. And our friend Betsy, who's just joining us, I'm sure will speak more authoritatively than I can about Thomas Cole, because she is the director of the Cedar Grove, the Thomas Cole's former residence in Catskill, and a place that I would recommend to anyone who's interested in seeing this school of painting.
Should we introduce
Let's.
Betsy, who's just arrived here at the studio? And Betsy, get close to the microphone. This is Betsy Jacks, or formerly Elizabeth B. Jacks. She's the executive director of the, it's a long name, the Cedar Grove, the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill, New York, just right across the river from Hudson. She previously was the marketing director for the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City, and she also is a visual artist. So welcome, Betsy.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Betsy, we were just talking about, I just asked Peter to explain what the Hudson River School is, and how would you explain it from your point of view at the Thomas Cole House?
Short answer is that it's America's first major school of art. And the long answer is that it's really an art movement that changed the way we see our country. And I would say it started around 1825 when Thomas Cole first came to this area. And he painted scenery right all around us here, which was painted in a very new way. It was painted as an outsider, he was from England originally, looking at American scenery as different than European scenery and saying, wow, this is completely untouched. This is wild. This doesn't exist in many other parts of the world. This is something unique. And so through their artwork, Americans came to appreciate the beauty around them as really our national treasures.
And I look at someone like Thomas Cole, who, when he came to the United States, he was in his teens, and for really starting a movement like this, for a major movement, he was in his early 20s, wasn't he?
He was. When he first came here, he was 24. So it is mind-boggling. In fact, when he first displayed his paintings at a gallery in New York City, it was really just in the windows of a storefront. A much more experienced and established figure in the New York art scene said, I am at once astonished and a bit ashamed because this young man has done at once what I have spent a lifetime trying to do.
For Thomas Cole at that point, did he have a benefactor, or was he getting commissioned artwork?
He was penniless when he started out. There's some famous stories about his walking across Pennsylvania with a blanket around his back. I mean, he just had absolutely nothing. But luckily, because of this exhibition in the window of a New York City bookstore in 1825, he was discovered by some of the most powerful people in New York. And overnight, literally, I mean, his name was in newspapers that spread around the country. So in a manner of speaking, overnight, he became a sensation, and patrons began calling him up and offering him commissions.
I know this is maybe a weird question to ask, but how much was he getting for a painting?
It is. It's a sad story, really, because he needed the money so badly, but his first painting sold for only about $10.
And in relationship to now, what would $10 represent?
Oh, gosh, I can't even do the math.
Maybe $100.
Maybe. Not enough.
Not enough. And when he came and started painting, others followed, and sort of representing the so-called first generation.
Yes. Well, when Cole was painting, if you look at when the other painters started, it's decades later. I mean, there was really, the Hudson River School was a one-man band, if you will, for a while. There were other landscape painters, to be sure, but as far as this particular angle on landscape painting, this particular style, he was on his own for a long time. And then when Cole was in his 40s, a young whippersnapper named Frederick Church came to study with him. And Church was only in his teens, but Cole was considered the established landscape painter in America. So Church, being from a very wealthy family and wanting to learn landscape painting, asked if he could come. And so Church then became, as everyone knows, one of the most celebrated painters in American history. So the school then, the school in quotes, there was no school, right? It's a movement. Mm-hmm. But it expanded from there to include hundreds of artists over the course of about 50 years.
Well, the term Hudson River School wasn't really coined for quite a while, was it? Wasn't it sort of late in... Was it after Cole?
It was. It was considerably after. And sadly, this manner of painting sort of fell into disrepair. America forgot about it for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. We should have been buying these pictures in the 1950s and 60s when no one cared. These fabulous paintings were going into dumpsters, believe mm-hmm. it or not. A lot of them have been lost in fires and so forth. And here we are right here in the epicenter of where it was painted. Locally here we had Frederick Church, we had Thomas Cole, we had Sanford Robinson Gifford, we had Arthur and Ernest Parton right here in Hudson. There's a fellow named Hubbard, another sort of a second tier artist. All of these folks were painting within a couple miles of where we sit right now. Mm. And I opened my gallery in Hudson 22 years ago, and I'm still waiting for the proverbial little old lady to come walking in the door with a masterpiece. It took me a very long time to realize it's not going to happen. And the reason being, the great important finished works by these painters were not necessarily sold here locally. They were painted for collectors or, you know, people of means in metropolitan areas. So there aren't a great deal of these important Hudson River school pictures floating around in local attics. Now, if there is, and anyone would like to bring one to my gallery, you'd be very well received. But I have many friends in the art trade who say to me, Peter, you live right smack dab in the middle of all of us. Surely you must be swimming in Hudson River paintings. And I say, no, they're not terribly abundant here locally.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really don't have a place to show them, unless it's the Thomas Cole House or the Frederick Church House.
Right.
But we're probably also talking only a few dozen painters who were a part of this movement, are we?
That were local?
Who were local and studied together. And I was reading, which I thought very fascinating. I mean, there's a couple things I'd like to talk about, because it can be an oh my gosh moment, at least for the two of you. For me, as a simple visual artist, when I took the trip to Olana and they were talking about Frederick Church and basically calling him a rock star, he was treated primarily like what would be, you know, like Mick Jagger or somebody. And they were mentioning his 1859 painting that he showed in New York City. I think it was 1859 for Frederick Church, and had admission to come see it. And he basically was making money from the admissions without selling the painting, eventually selling the painting for $10,000, which at that time was the largest amount of money paid for a living American artist. Now we're well into the multi millions for many artists, but for 1859, before the Civil War, that's my perspective of being awesome.
Yes. Church was a master at the art of not only painting but of promotion, and he did have this. He did this frequently, where he would put a painting on display and charge admission to come see it. And not only that, but he would drape it in drapery and reveal it at a dramatic moment and have dramatic lighting and encourage people to bring their opera glasses so that there's little binoculars so that they could see the painting details. And it was quite a show and a very successful one.
The picture you're referring to, Chad, is called Heart of the Andes. Mm-hmm. It's a magnificent painting. It's at the Met, at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and it's in this spectacular sort of walnut encasement.
Isn't it about 5 feet by 10 feet?
It's large. It's I don't large. Remember the specific dimensions, but it's a big picture, and it's a view in South America. And one of the things I think about when I think about the Hudson River School is that many of these paintings were painted pre-photography. In other words, photography wasn't commercially and widely available. So if you wanted a vista of, let's say, South America or Morocco or Syria or some of the exotic places that these painters traveled to, it was their paintings and drawings that brought those images back for American consumption, because it wasn't possible to just go out into the field with your little snapshot camera and bring these images back. So one of the most extraordinary aspects of the Hudson River School of Painting is that the artists traveled tremendous distances and under difficult conditions. I mean, they were taking mules and pack horses and so forth back into difficult to reach places. And oftentimes what they would do is sketch in the wild. In other words, they'd do pencil sketches of their paintings and then execute them back in the studio. They weren't taking a 6 or 7 foot canvas out into the wild. And in New York, there was a place called the 10th Street Studio. In fact, there's a book out about this particular spot where a number of the great painters collectively shared a studio space, and that's where many of the pictures were actually executed from pencil sketches.
Wasn't that the first artist studio to be purposely built in New York City? In New York City, yeah.
Right until that last phrase, I was going to say, that's Thomas Cole's studio right here in Catskill.
So close.
That one was from 1839, which predates the 10th Street Studio building by quite a bit. But yeah, that one is famous in New York City. It had not only Frederick Church, but Albert Bierstadt and a number of these amazing artists all in one place. If we could only visit that studio, wouldn't that be incredible?
I've seen photos of the interior, and it was spectacular. They had high ceilings, and they had these magnificent wooden easels, you know, those great big old easels with cranks and so forth. And they had their studios decorated with all kinds of things that they had brought back from their travels. You know, they might have a blanket from Persia, or they might have spears from North Africa. You know, it was a very exotic setting. And I think those places are probably where they met their wealthy patrons and discussed, showed them their work, and perhaps put their business deals together right there at those studios.
I mean, would an artist of that period actually want a patron or someone say, can you paint me a picture of a waterfall? And would the artist say, how much? And yes, I will. Or would they be more discriminative and I'll paint you what I will paint?
Well, both of those did happen. Thomas Cole wrote a lot in his journal about how he really wished he could just paint what he wanted to paint, but his patrons had other ideas. And so in some examples, the patron would say, just paint me a picture. There was an architect at the time, Ithiel Towne, who just told Thomas Cole to paint him an American scene. And Thomas Cole produced this fantastic scene of different architectural styles for the architect. He had Gothic and he had Egyptian and, you know, all kinds of things in this painting. And it was rejected. The patron said, I just wanted trees and lakes. And the painting hung in Thomas Cole's home the rest of his life. It never sold. So they had these kinds of experiences. And then there were these dream patrons who really did want the artist to paint whatever he wished. And Lyman Reed was one of these patrons. Cole would say, I am imagining this series of paintings for your living room, this 5 gigantic paintings that show the course of civilization over the generations. And Lyman Reed said, go for it. And so Cole could just paint whatever he wanted. Unfortunately, Lyman Reed died right in the middle of that commission.
Wasn't Cole also basically an architect? Didn't he love architecture and multi-talented?
Yes, he did. He designed, little known fact, he designed the Ohio State Capitol building, among other things. But yes, in fact, he designed himself a magnificent studio that stood right near his home in Catskill for many, many years. It was demolished in the 1970s, but we have very good photographs of it and other evidence of what it looked like. A beautiful building. It had windows that were two stories high and just let in tons of light, and it had this elaborate cornice of delicate work all over the building. Beautiful thing. And we do plan to restore it and put it back.
Well, Betsy, for our readers, for those that have never been to Cedar Grove, can you paint us a picture on the radio?
Oh, certainly. Well, right now, when you come, you'll see this beautiful main house, which is a brick building painted a pale yellow, and it has a wraparound porch with a view of the Catskills that is unparalleled. It makes you want to be a landscape painter. And so we give tours of this beautiful home where Cole lived his life and where this art movement began. In addition, on the property is his first studio, which is a modest structure. It's a barn. And it's poetic, really, that this great landscape painter was painting his pieces that became internationally known right in this barn on the property. And, you know, it just had a fireplace in the corner to keep him warm. It's really astounding space to see. At the same time, it's very beautiful inside. The walls have been lined with brick, and you see his original easels in there, which are enormous. And so you can imagine the paintings that would have sat on those easels. So you really get a picture of this man and how he worked from the visit.
And Thomas Cole did not have a long life, a long career. Was it 1848 that he passed away?
Yeah, he was only 47 years old.
And so what happened to his house after that time? I mean, he was married and had children, so did it stay in the family?
It did. It stayed in the family right up until it became a public museum, so it never belonged to anybody else. The family was there until the 1970s, and then it was taken over by one group after another trying to make it into a museum, but somewhat unsuccessfully for a while. It just, the Hudson River School of Art itself was not that popular. The money could never be found. The house continued to fall into disrepair. And then in 1998, the Greene County Historical Society took it over, led by a very passionate advocate, the Greene County historian at the time. His name was Raymond Beecher. He really led the charge, and committees were formed and grants were written, and the main house was completely restored, and then followed by the studio a few years later.
Wasn't there actually a yard sale in the front lawn at some point?
Yes, this is this is one of those things that you just really wish you could go back in time and visit. In 1964, the family, the Cole family that was living there, decided that, you know, we're just going to move to Florida. This is, you know, we're tired of the Hudson Valley, so we don't need all this stuff. And they had a great auction right on the lawn in front of the house, and auctioned off many a Cole painting that day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Peter.
As a dealer, I'm weeping.
Yeah. Maybe there's a list of those who purchased and go after them.
I think actually some of the objects that were sold in that yard sale have trickled back to the house in recent years, haven't they?
They have. Unfortunately, no paintings yet, although we're still waiting. But a very generous man gave back the full set of china, the family china. Mm. It was this beautiful hand-painted set of china. I mean, it's just a large number of pieces, beautiful thing. And there was a wonderful piece sold, which was Thomas Cole's original paint box, which it was a wooden box that he would take with him when he went out sketching outside. And he could carry his paints in there, as well as brushes and maybe a few boards to paint on. And so this fantastic object has come back. It has one of his paintings on the lid.
Oh, fantastic.
Beautiful thing.
I should probably convey the story of Thomas Cole's guitar, which is another thing that has come back to the house in the most miraculous way. A few years ago, I was driving down the road and I got a call on my cell phone from my friend Dave, who's a fellow in the art and antiques trade. And he said, "Peter, I'm standing at an auction out on Cape Cod, and Thomas Cole's guitar is coming up for sale." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I think I'm going to buy the ultimate piece of Hudson River rock and roll memorabilia." And he did, and ultimately, through a generous benefactor, it found its way back to the Kohl House. And it's a guitar, it's a little Italian guitar, very small in proportion, that is actually featured in one of Thomas Kohl's paintings that resides in the Brooklyn Museum called The Picnic, in which he actually features himself standing at this picnic playing the guitar. So that guitar has come full circle and ended up back at the Kohl House, which I just think is a marvelous story and a happy ending.
It's a beautiful thing.
Well, when we look at Thomas Kohl's life as the starting point of the Hudson River School, Betsy, how many paintings do you think he actually did? And B, how many are still existing?
That is a very good question. There's a project that remains to be done, which is, it's called a catalogue raisonné, but it means someone goes out there and does this research. Where are all these paintings, and can we list them all? It's not been done. There has never been a catalogue raisonné for Thomas Kohl, which is amazing, an artist of that importance. Many other artists have this body of work already done. So, the answer is we don't know how many paintings are out there. We created a website called explorethomaskohl.org, and we have been putting images of his paintings in there as they come up. And we have about nearly 200 in there right now. But these are mainly the major paintings. It doesn't include, I've seen hundreds of little ones, little studies, all kinds of things. But we hope to gradually grow this over time, and it can be kind of a repository for the Thomas Kohl paintings.
And what about Frederick Church? Do we know those numbers?
I don't know. There is a catalogue raisonné on Church. It's actually out of print, I think, and rare and expensive at the moment. But I don't know right offhand the total number of pictures he painted. Of course, they're extremely valuable. I mean, if you were to list the high priests of Hudson River School pictures, Kohl, Church, and Gifford, who grew up right here. In fact, Chad, right behind you, if you look out the window, is a railroad track that runs right through the center of our little city park. You'll see occasional train cars going through there with grain from the ADM mill up the road. That little rail line was put in there to serve the Gifford Iron Works. The Gifford Iron Works was up here a little bit to the east of us. And in the 19th century, the Gifford Iron Works, the Gifford family, had enough political sway to somehow manage to get that railroad right through the center of town and right to subdivide our little village green here. It's an extraordinary thing, and it functions until this day. Gifford is buried here in our local cemetery, and some years ago I happened to be walking through the cemetery with a friend and came right upon his family plot. There were 22 family members there, and this again was another goosebump moment for me. I couldn't believe it. He's buried on a rather steep hillside. All the stones in the plot had been tipped over or were damaged in some fashion, and through the generosity of some people in the art world, I was able to raise enough money, hired a brilliant young stonemason named Aldo Lavaggi. Aldo spent about 6 months up there putting it all back together, and the stones are cleaned and they've been reset. They all sat on a marble base that weighed about 300 pounds. All those bases had to be extracted from the ground, reset, and put back into good order. And there's a website that we've put up. It's called Gifford's Grave. So if you just do an online search for Gifford's Grave, you'll come to the site. You'll see pictures of what it looked like prior to restoration and after restoration. And you'll also see images of some of Gifford's paintings. And there are links there to Olana and the Kohl House and other sites. But Gifford was a tremendous painter. He born in 1823, died in 1880. So he didn't have a terribly long life. He lived to be 57. But a terrific painter. He does atmosphere really, really well. You can practically feel the humidity in his pictures. And he's also quite faithful to the truth. Some of the Hudson River School painters could be criticized for going a little overboard and dramatizing or overly romanticizing the landscape, mountains that are sort of ridiculous and a sunset to go with them. Gifford was not like that. Gifford painted the truth, and he was very faithful to nature, and he's a fabulous painter.
Well, what was the luminosity period?
Yeah, that's a sort of subset of the Hudson River School. There are people, painters that are called luminous painters. Mm. And the boundaries here are a little fuzzy. I mean, these are terms that we use in the art trade, but I think it would be pretty difficult to precisely define who the luminous painters were. Betsy, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's sort of a style. You can say this particular painting has some luminism in it, but yeah, I would agree with Peter, loosely defined. But I'd also like to say, just back to the Gifford grave thing, it was an incredible gift to posterity that you led this effort to save the grave. It's amazing. I mean, Peter deserves immense congratulations and thanks.
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was a labor of love, and it continues. As I raise a little more money, I hope to perhaps put a 19th century cast iron fence around the plot.
Wonderful.
which is nice. It's in the portion of the cemetery that's closest to the hospital, up on a rather steep bank, which accounts for the fact that the stones were tipping over and falling downhill. And also, the cemetery was located almost immediately adjacent to a big rock quarry where there was blasting for about 100 years. Mm. So the stones up there have suffered over time. And our cemetery is a magnificent place. It would take multiple millions to get it restored properly. But what I'm hoping is that my project could at least provide that first spark of interest. And our cemetery is actually designed according to the principles of the rural cemetery movement, which originated in Europe in the 19th century. And it's something I didn't know until I undertook this project, but it's a wonderful thing. In the first half of the 19th century, the big European cities, London, Paris, Berlin, they were actually having a problem stacking up too many deceased bodies in their cemeteries. It got to be a public health issue and a matter of space. So they started designing brand new cemeteries out on the perimeter of cities to get them out of the central portion of the city. And they called this the rural cemetery movement. And it's a beautiful notion, the idea being, if you're going to have a cemetery, why not make it an attractive civic space that could be enjoyed by the whole community? Mm-hmm. So you have winding paths and beautiful architecture and benches to sit on and fountains and vistas. The idea that you're not just building some place to park the deceased, you're actually building an attractive park that could act as a resource for the whole community to be enjoyed. And to sort of, you know, cemeteries, people typically think of them as dark and scary places. Well, they don't have to be. They can be sort of a history lesson for the community, a place where you'd like to spend time, a place where you enjoy being, taking a walk with your child or your dog or whatever. And Hudson Cemetery, which is actually called Cedar Grove or Cedar Park, was designed according to those very enlightened 19th century principles.
I think Poughkeepsie also has one similar. A feast for the eye, I think they were probably designed for, with fountains and beautiful stones.
Yep.
And pathways and particular trees that bloom at certain times of the year, almost like Central Park in a way. And cemeteries were meant to be visited.
Yes. I think the first important one is in Boston. I think Troy has a particularly beautiful one. There's also one down in the New York City area, a very large one, and they're lovely places. And ours, unfortunately, has fallen into disrepair and would need substantial funding to get it back into good shape. But it sure would be nice, because it's a wonderful place. Now, I don't have any desire myself to be buried under a stone. I think it's a little silly, especially, you know, when somebody builds a 20-foot monument to themselves. I'm happy to be cremated and scattered off the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. But I do have to say that I enjoy cemeteries and the architecture we see in them. So my ambition for my retirement is to be the weird old guy who hangs out in the cemetery.
Well, they're also big tourist attractions when you're talking about having a famous person buried there. Mm. And I think that it's just so fantastic that now Sanford Gifford's grave has been restored to the point where we can proudly promote it as such, that you can visit this gravesite of this famous artist. And we've put together this program called the Hudson River School Art Trail, which is a map of all these sites that primarily it's the sites of the views of the Hudson River School paintings. But we'll also put on things like this gravesite, so it really enhances the visit for people who come here.
And Thomas Cole is buried in Catskill.
Yes, he is. Actually, right down the street from the main house is this beautiful cemetery where he was buried. It has a view overlooking the mountains, which he painted so many times. So, it's easily walked to from his house. It's only about 2 blocks away.
And can you see the Thomas Cole Mountain from the house?
You know, it's funny. There is a Thomas Cole Mountain, but you can't see it from the house. It's behind another large mountain that you can see from the house. But we put up on the porch of Thomas Cole's house an exhibit that shows the whole mountain profile with all the peaks identified. So you can stand there and look out and figure out what was what. And we have a little arrow that says, Thomas Cole's Mountain is right behind here.
There's another artist we should mention who's a bit off the radar, but he's important. His name was Henry Airy. Airy actually had a art supply store here on Warren Street in Hudson. Mm. And he was the person who taught Sanford Gifford. He gave him his first lessons. And he sold paint and canvas right out of his little shop, just a couple doors from where my gallery is now. His paintings are a little on the folky side. They're not as highly evolved as Gifford and Cole and Church. But he was right here, and I like to think that, you know, all the great Hudson River painters were shopping for paint and canvas, at Henry Airy's little shop on Warren Street.
Has every house in the area been unturned, every rock, and attic been searched? Because I would imagine, I always keep my fingers crossed that something interesting can still be found.
Well, I have a few anecdotes on that, actually. Maybe give Peter a little hope. But when Thomas Cole's descendants had taken over the house, and throughout the 20th century, they had no money. And so they started first selling paintings and then giving them away. So I do think there are some in the immediate area that we haven't uncovered. I have one story, though, that just breaks my heart. Breaks anyone's heart who I tell it to, but I saw it on a blog online and an anonymous post, so I can't even contact the person. But evidently, they said that there was a large Thomas Cole painting above the fireplace of their grandmother's house when they were growing up, and it was an enormous thing. And this man's grandmother loved it, but his mother hated it, and so his mother would always say, why don't you get rid of that thing, that awful thing, and it became this sort of family joke, please get rid of that thing. And so one day when the boy came home, he found the grandmother throwing scraps of it into the fire along with the leaves.
That'll keep her warm.
Does that just kill you?
When do you think this was?
Well, the man telling the story, it was a blog post, but he seemed to be a man rather than a little boy. So, and he's describing his grandmother. This is the best I know.
The worst thing that happened, as far as I'm concerned, is the emergence of the Antiques Roadshow. It used to be, that if somebody had something halfway interesting in their attic, they might bring it to someone like myself here on Main Street. That doesn't happen anymore. If they get something interesting, they do an online search, and it ends up on Madison Avenue in about 15 minutes, or ends up with Sotheby's or Christie's or something. So the paintings of the Hudson River School don't percolate up through this little network of dealers the way they used to. Mm. They tend to rise to the top of the food chain very quickly.
Now, Peter, you might be able to answer this question. Normally when we go into a museum or a fine gallery and we see a classic painting from 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, and let's say the Hudson River School, it's often a very ornate frame, and there is normally a little plaque at the bottom identifying the painter, the year, and the title. Was that something that was done from the very beginning of when the painting was created?
Yes. Quite a few of the Hudson River painters had plaques made. I don't know that they did them themselves. I think there was somebody professionally doing the plaques. And oftentimes the plaques themselves are little masterpieces. They have the most glorious sort of script on them, and they'll usually include a title for the painting. And sometimes they're on metal, on brass. Sometimes they're on wood. But I actually have a collection of those in a cigar box back at the gallery. I love those little plaques. And there are contemporary makers of those plaques. And when I'm offering a painting for sale, I love to include a plaque. It gives it a little more importance. And if the signature on the painting isn't all that legible, which sometimes they aren't, it's nice to have it on the plaque so that anyone viewing the painting has a better sense of who the artist is and what the dates might be.
Well, would every painter sign a painting?
Pretty much. Although there are many, many, many unsigned paintings. I mean, some of the unsigned paintings we have are circulating because when the artist passed away, there was a supply of them left over in the studio. Thomas Cole or Frederick Church or any of those artists may have died with 30 or 40 or 100 paintings still kicking around the studio. And in many instances, some of those weren't signed. So then what happens is that there are sort of designated experts in the field who you go to, and hopefully they will examine a picture. And if they're sufficiently convinced that it's genuine and that it embodies all the stylistic traits of a particular artist, they will write a letter saying, yes, in my opinion, this is a genuine example of the work of, you know, Thomas Cole.
Now, the Hudson River School was an art movement. My curiosity wants to know, why did it get started? Why did other painters and the public gravitate towards this, the nation's first art movement?
I could speak to that. Why did it get started? Why did it take off? You know, it's two separate questions. But at the time, there was a growing sense of national pride, kind of nationalism in general. People were looking for something that was uniquely American. You know, it was still a new country at that time. You were talking about 1825. And so much of what people valued and saw and dealt with every day was imported from somewhere. And they yearned for something American. You know, now we think, oh, American. Okay, so we have apple pie, we have baseball. You know, we have a pretty good sense of what it means to be American. But back then, they really wanted to define this. What is American? And so when they saw art that was different, really different from other art that had come before or that was coming from Europe, it was a real sense of national pride that propelled Thomas Cole to this piece of situation of fame. So I would say nationalism was a big part. The other part was that I think Peter alluded to this earlier, that there wasn't photography, and the places that some of these painters were going were really out there. So I think you would compare it to a probe going to Mars and imagine, how excited we were to see the pictures that came back from Mars. What does it look like on the surface of Mars? You know, we wanted to know. And I think that is what it was like to see these pictures from South America and places that were just not reachable by most people. It was just amazing to see what these foreign places actually looked like. So there was this growing tourism. Thomas Cole was mainly working here in the Catskills. These places were visitable, if that's a word, by the average or sort of middle to upper middle class person in New York City. So they became advertisements as well for places that you could go.
There was also a spiritual dimension to the Hudson River School of Painting. I think a lot of the artists were expressing their sense of the divine through their paintings. They were in awe of the American landscape, as Betsy said, and in particular the ones that have the glorious luminous sunsets with this light that seems to be embedded in the paint itself. Those are expressions of spiritual reverie.
Yeah, Thomas Cole really felt that his paintings were statements of religion, because the places that he painted, he felt were God's direct works. These are God's creations. And he compared them to the landscapes of Europe, which had been overrun by armies and farmers, and the landscape was just completely altered by humankind, whereas the American landscape, in Thomas Cole's view, had just been created by God and no one had messed it up. You know, so it was the direct work of some divine, and that would, by painting it, you could get closer and understand God in a more direct way.
Wasn't one of the painters had taken a trip out west and made some wonderful Yosemite paintings and came back, and there was a story that there was a tableau that was created with real Indians standing in front of the painting to give a more realistic experience. And when I see all the paintings that these painters have done, that just seems like that's the 3D aspect of like going to a movie. But these painters were going places that other people would never go. Certainly in the late 19th century, when photography was taking over, they had the stereoscope to sort of add to that, because frankly, I don't think photography could accomplish the same thing that these painters were accomplishing.
I think it sounds like you're referring to Albert Bierstadt, and the painters over the course of the 19th century kept pushing the boundary of what was the next exotic, far off, unreachable, interesting place to go. And in 1825, it was the Catskills, because that was still very undeveloped. And then in Albert Bierstadt's time, it became the West and the Rockies, as you describe. And then, you know, Frederick Church went all over the world. So they kept pushing it back. And we have a show that we're going to be opening at the Thomas Cole House on May 1st of Albert Bierstadt's paintings. Mm. He became really well known as a painter of the American West, and that's how everybody pictures Bierstadt. He's one of the most beloved American painters for that. But he actually lived and worked right here in the Hudson Valley. He had a studio, he had an enormous mansion right here, and it's very little studied and little known, but he had beautiful paintings of this area. So that's what we plan to show in our upcoming exhibition.
Now, you have Salon Sundays.
Yes.
That have already started, and I made note the one actually coming up this weekend. I love that the title is What Made Cole Epic.
Yes.
And Christopher Phillips will be doing that. And the term epic was for the first time associated that word as a critique on Cole's work. I mean, back in the early 18th century, I'd love that.
Yeah. Yeah, you conjure up heroes and villains and
epic.
Great deeds, and you know, the word epic really captures your imagination, and it hadn't really been applied to an American painter before. Mm. But this speaker this Sunday at 2:00 will talk about what made Cole's paintings epic, and you know, it's not just a term that was popular in the medieval ages. It's a term that is immensely popular throughout our history, and he will show why it has this enduring appeal for us.
And Peter, I want to go to you a little bit. And knowing a lot of artists around here, painters who do paint on canvas and have their canvases stretched, and you know, we're seeing them while fresh. They're only a couple years old. But you've been experiencing paintings that are decades and hundreds of years old. What happens to a painting over time?
Well, that question sort of takes us to the whole area of repair and restoration, which is actually just about my favorite part of the whole business. I wish we were on TV so I could show everyone pictures of how much a painting can transform. It's extraordinary. Any picture that's 100 years old or more, 150 years old, is probably going to have some condition issues. There'll be little nicks and chips. There could be flaking. There could be craquelure in the paint that comes from shrinkage. There could be entire sections of the painting absolutely missing. The frame could be broken or damaged or, in some cases, gone altogether. So if we're lucky enough to find a Hudson River School picture in fresh condition, just the way it came out of grandmother's attic, it likely is going to need some amount of tune-up. I happen to work very closely with a conservation shop over in Connecticut, a fellow by the name of Tom Yost, who's an absolutely brilliant restorer. He's got a staff of about 6 or 8 people, and it's a pretty high-tech science involving some diagnostic equipment and so forth. And one of my favorite things to do is to go visit that shop, bring them a few pictures in need of work, and then pick up the new ones that he's just finished, and it's always a great pleasure to see a picture restored to good condition, and hopefully it's stable and in good shape for the next 100 years. Paintings, oil paintings have a layer of varnish on top of them, and the varnish does a couple things. First of all, it protects against debris embedding itself directly in the paint, so any kind of dirt or particulate matter will be lying on top of the varnish, not in the paint. And the other thing is that oil paint in its natural state is kind of flat and dull, and it needs a little varnish to make it sparkle. For instance, if you have snow or water in a painting, you need enough varnish to give it a little bit of depth and sparkle. So restorers have become extremely skilled at bringing pictures back to good health. And this is a fairly recent phenomena. Unfortunately, repair and restoration was not a very highly evolved science a few years ago, and a lot of people went after paintings with oven cleaner and Brillo pads, believe it or not. And they would skin them. They would clean them too aggressively, and sometimes the painting would lose its brush texture, and that brush texture is a big part of what makes an oil painting attractive and gives it dimension. But now we have a number of good shops who do first-class work, and we also have great framing. We have people who are capable of making very convincing reproductions of 19th century frames, and they're also capable of good repair. Right here in Hudson, we have a shop downtown. There's a fellow named Ami Rebar who deals in beautiful vintage frames of the period. And then above him, upstairs, is a German gal named Tanya McGivney, who does brilliant frame restoration. And so I'm fortunate that right here in my block, I've got some first-class people to work with on framing issues.
Betsy, when they're the paintings at the Thomas Cole House, how do you protect those?
Well, we, like many museums, carefully monitor our temperature and humidity levels. We have little monitors in each room that send a digital signal back to the main computer that tell us at any given time what is the temperature in that room and what is the humidity in that room. Because the key is not to have a change too quickly. So it's okay to have a change of 10 or even 20 degrees if it happens very slowly over time. It gives the paint a little chance to expand without cracking, for example. And same thing with the finish on a piece of furniture. You don't want it to start peeling off if suddenly the room gets really dried out. So we carefully monitor our environment in the institution. But also, we do have some pieces when they come in that need some cleaning or restoration. And we had a piece that was hanging in the local library in Catskill. Just the little beautiful public library in Catskill had this enormous Thomas Cole painting hanging over the fireplace. And no one really noticed it because I think maybe everyone assumed it was a copy. How could this be just sitting right here? But it was behind a piece of glass. And it was a mixed blessing, I think, that protected it from someone putting their pencil through it or something like that. But unfortunately, it got some water in between the canvas and the glass. The roof had leaked and some water came down in. So the painting had been very badly damaged by the water. In fact, paint was peeling off and was kind of collecting down in the bottom of the frame. And it was a sad sight to behold. So we brought it to this premier place in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where they do a lot of museum work. And when we got this painting back, you would swear Thomas Cole had painted it yesterday. It was an amazing transformation. I mean, it took months and months of work and a lot of money, but it was absolutely astounding. So that painting now hangs at the Thomas Cole House from April through October, and then at Vassar College from November through April.
And since we're getting close to the end of the program, I want to get to the end of the movement, the Hudson River movement. After a while, it started to come out of favor in the late 19th century. What were the reasons for that?
Well, I've heard some very convincing arguments that it was really the Civil War that undid the Hudson River School. We had a speaker at the Cole House a couple years ago named John Stilgo from Harvard who said that the Hudson River School paintings were full of optimism and innocence of a new country that thought that their future ahead of them was just unbounded and that we could do anything as a nation. We had unlimited resources. The future's just so bright, and the paintings have that optimism and that beauty built into them. And the Civil War just shattered. People said at the time that you could just no longer bear to look at those paintings because it was like looking at your marriage after a divorce. They couldn't bear it.
So did things, of course, modern painting Impressionism started to take over, but as an American art movement, was that basically the end, or was there a metamorphosis?
There was a sort of transitional period that comes after the Hudson River School. Some of the American painters were starting to be influenced by the Barbizon painters in France. Barbizon's a little village where the great French painter Corot taught, and a lot of people from all over the world went to study with Corot in the 1870s and 1880s. And I think the influence of that style of painting changed. It started to, a lot of people began to regard Hudson River School painting as old-fashioned because they started seeing this looser, more atmospheric kind of painting. They started to see Monet. Even Van Gogh was active in the 1880s. And so I think the influence of Europe to some extent altered and perhaps brought about the sort of the twilight of the Hudson River School. You know, one thing before I forget, if folks are inspired to go out and see some good Hudson River School picture, there's a wonderful show up at the Albany Institute that just was hung in the last couple weeks, and I think it runs all the way through August. I was up there last week and saw it. There are 125 paintings, and quite a few early ones out of the 1830s and 40s, plus a fair bit of ephemera, little letters and drawings and souvenirs and things. It's a wonderful show, and the Albany Institute is on Washington, just down from the state capitol. I'd highly recommend that show.
I second that. I saw it, and it's beautifully done.
And speaking of the Thomas Cole House, is it open year-round?
We have lectures and programs year-round. As you mentioned, we have a lecture this Sunday, and you can come and see the house at that time. And then starting May 1st, we open up our visitor center and give regular tours. And that's when our show opens as well. Our Albert Bierstadt exhibition will open May 1st.
And also, one last thing I'd like to add is that there are a few folks around contemporary painters who are working in the style again, and I'm very encouraged by them. In particular, there's a young gal from Columbia County here by the name of Lauren Sansarique and her friend Eric Keppel, and I've been seeing work from them that's just wonderful, and it's very much in the style of the Hudson River painters, and I hope it spreads.
I do, too. Good art is often hard to find. So just to remind our listeners, you've been listening to The Art of the Hudson Valley, and our two guests have been Peter Young and Betsy Jacks, and want to make sure that people know Olana is www.olana.org, and Thomas Cole is
www.thomascole.org.
Pretty darn simple.
Easy to remember.
And visit those websites to find what program is going on. It's they're kind of the gateway, the two houses being on opposite sides of the Hudson River, the gateway to the Hudson Valley, along with the Rip Van Winkle Bridge in between.
And if anybody's interested in a tour of the Hudson Cemetery and Gifford's Grave, they're welcome to come find me and we'll go together. I love going up there. I'm there a lot. And spring's coming. It'll be beautiful. The daffodils will be popping up all around Gifford.
Oh, I'll be looking forward to it. I love the cemetery. I'm a big lover of cemeteries. I think they're awesome. So I just want to conclude. We are done with our hour. And looking out the window where the Giffords put the railroad track, we'll bid everybody adieu. And thank you for listening. This has been Chad Weckler.